My name is Naomi He Kohler, and I am the director of the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. My paternal grandparents were Holocaust survivors. My grandfather lost every member of his family, and growing up, his silence and also my grandmother's stories of what it was like to go through Auschwitz and elsewhere really were quite formative. And on my mother's side of the family were Christian, they were part of the Danish resistance, and those stories really also helped to motivate me in terms of what is the good that people can do to try to help others. And really at the very start of the Syrian uprising, I started working with colleagues, including from Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, and elsewhere in a former job, engaging, and I spent about 8 years engaging the UN Security Council, the various UN actors, member states on Syria. It was incredibly, at times, humbling and frustrating work, and after 8 years, especially the years that I worked on Syria, I found myself often thinking that we were just shouting into the wind. Because Syria was an instance where it would be very hard for anyone to say that they did not know. The crimes were happening in real time. They were unfolding before cameras around the world in terms of, you know, on the news, in our newspapers. Remarkable and heroic Syrian civil society organizations were working incredibly hard to bring detailed information about the atrocities to light. But we still were faced with unbelievable inaction. And that's not to say there wasn't anything done. There were efforts taken, especially by individual states, to sanction individuals, diplomatic engagement. There were a lot of measures that were taken, but it wasn't translating into action on the ground. And in all honesty, when I left New York, my heart felt kind of broken because it was hard to look at Syria and not feel a sense of despair that the world, in a sense, didn't care. So one of the things that we started to try to do at the museum was really think strategically about how do you humanize what is happening in Syria? Who are the people that we would want to bring to Washington to have their stories told if we could get them into the country, which was a real challenge? Who are the people that we wanted to bring to the White House, to Capitol Hill? And doing some of that storytelling, both in terms of the exhibit that we'll talk more about, the videos that we produced, but also the events that we would hold, how to do that in a way that really counters intentionally that framing that the Assad regime was so effective in trying to advance. And the reality is the brunt of the work is done by the people who are in the countries that we are focused on. And they're often the unsung heroes, and they often don't have the support that's required. And they're often doing that work because the international community has failed. And I think what is incredibly hard, and when we think about Caesar and we think about all of our Syrian colleagues, is they somehow find the ability and the power and the inner resolve to keep going, even in the face of feeling so often like they are sharing really powerful, personal, painful information and experiences, and nothing is being done. We built this exhibit, and the exhibit was incredibly powerful. It was called Syria, Please Don't Forget Us. And it told the story of detention, it told the story of the uprising, it told the story of the horrific mass atrocities that have been committed, through essentially one individual and the 82 people that he was held in detention with. And that individual is Mansour Omari, who's a journalist, and he smuggled on 5 sheets of cloth that he wove into his clothing. On those 5 sheets of cloth were 82 names of people that he was detained with, that were tortured, that were held in detention. And they wrote their names on those cloths using blood and rust. And, you know, it's just incredibly painful to think about each of those 82 individuals and what they represent in regards to the hundreds of thousands who shared and share a similar fate. But the power of the exhibit was that we endeavored to try to tell in an ethical way the story of those 82 people and the story of Mansour through as much as possible his voice and his recollections. For some people, the Holocaust was off, you know, obviously 6 million Jews were killed, persecuted on the basis of their identity. I think for many people, at times they're surprised to see that an institution that was built to tell the narrative of one community, and notably the Jewish community, would stand in such solidarity with Syrian victims and survivors. And, you know, for us, it's always very powerful to say that we're focused on the human experience. It doesn't matter what a person's religion, ethnicity, nationality, political identity is. I mean, I think the fact that we have, you know, the first trial on state-perpetrated torture in Syria that was launched in Germany is really remarkable and groundbreaking. It has been long in the making in terms of actually being able to see this come to fruition. But the fact that we're actually seeing a case around crimes against humanity, the fact that you have organizations that are now representing, you know, 30 plus Syrian torture survivors who will hopefully, you know, through that experience also be able to have their experiences and voices heard is incredibly powerful. One of the things that we know from the Holocaust is for survivors, they will not give up on the pursuit of justice. You know, at the same time the Koblenz trial was going forward, I think it was launched in April of 2020, the German courts were also dealing with cases involving Holocaust perpetrators. So people who committed crimes 80 years ago. And again, like going back to that kind of common thread that we try to, in our work, help to evoke, that the denial of human dignity and what needs to be done in situations where you see these crimes occurring in such a profound way. I think it's incredibly stark that you've got these trials happening and happening in a country where they themselves committed horrific genocide and crimes against humanity is very powerful. But it's also humbling just to know how hard it is to build these cases. And I think one of the things that we really try to talk a lot about with our Syrian colleagues, but through our justice work with colleagues in South Sudan, in Iraq, in Burma, is also trying to help manage expectations, because we know that the road to justice can be so long that that term justice means so much and so many different things to different people, and that trials are just one avenue of really trying to advance accountability. And that when we think about transitional justice, there are so many different prongs that we need to be trying to move forward and advance.
What do you hope to see for Syria 10 years from now?
I mean, my hope is really that my friends and colleagues are able to go home and that they can live lives where they have the ability to flourish and where their commitment to human rights and to the respect of diversity are able to be part of their day-to-day life. And there's a lot that needs to happen in order for people to be able to go home and to be safe. And it's really humbling to think about that. But I think just on a very human level, you know, what I hope is that they don't have to continue to live lives of exile, because, you know, in a lot of the work that we do, part of our goal in that effort to try to kind of humanize the crisis and put a face to what is being talked about is also an effort to counter these really incredibly degrading perceptions that Syrians who are fleeing as refugees are doing so because they're, you know, wanting to take advantage of European countries or elsewhere. And everyone we work with, if you ask them what they want to do, they want to go home. They want to build the future of their country. I mean, these are people who have remarkable skills, energy, dedication, and they are transforming the countries that they are in today and that they've sought refuge in. And I'm in complete awe of them. But the reality is, what I hope in 10 years is that they're able to do all of that in pursuit of their own future in the country that they were born and they feel so passionately about, and that they and so many of their loved ones have suffered immense and really trauma that can never be completely repaired, but perhaps in some small way can be channeled to really trying to build a better future for Syria. So it's a really simplistic wish in terms of the core principle of, you know, what we as humans aspire for. But it's an incredibly difficult one when you think about the political realities, the security realities today in Syria.
Yeah.
You know, I hope that in 10 years we're all sitting down in Damascus or somewhere in Aleppo and having a really great meal, you know, and the incredible hospitality of the Syrian people is something that, you know, we can all enjoy. And the beauty and the history of the country, though it needs a lot of rebuilding, is something that is experienced and enjoyed by people all around the world. And that the story of Syria isn't opening up the pages, or I will be candid, wishing that we opened up the pages today and saw accounts of what was happening, because it is largely invisible, unfortunately, now. But that the kind of understanding of Syria is one of just a truly remarkable country that has contributed so much to the world and continues to. So that would be my 10-year hope,